I couldn't find the sheets at home, so I thought I must have left them here, but I couldn't find them here except for one. Today is our last shiur on Hashgacha Pratis in the Rambam. And what we're going to do is go backwards a little bit. We spent the last number of shiurim on 351, which is from the end of the book. We spent the first couple of shiurim on 317 and 318. And now we're going to go to 323, and we're going to start from the middle. 323 is all about the book of Iov. And the Rambam thinks that the book of Iov is all about Hashgacha. He essentially argues that the Iov struggled with the issue of Hashgacha. The five characters in Iov, his three friends, and then Elihu, who is at the end, represent the five different perspectives on Hashgacha that the Rambam outlined in 317. And there are really three discoveries that Elihu makes in the end, that Iov makes at the end, which resolve his questions. And it's a long chapter. I don't think we'll have a chance to do all of it. And really, to better appreciate this chapter, you have to actually learn Iov, which is no small feat. But we will start from... if you look at the preview from I'll just point it to you to this paragraph. Now I don't have this one, so we're going to be using different editions, but over here. So in the previous ones, you see in the previous one he talked about Zophar's opinion and then Eliphaz's. So so know and consider how the story, which has perplexed many people, is composed and called upon them to adopt various opinions that we have analyzed above concerning God's providence regarding the created things. All that is required by the classification is mentioned and ascribed to one of the men famous at that time because of virtue and knowledge. That would have to be said if this is a parable, or they might have expressed these opinions in true reality if this is a story that has happened. The opinion attributed to Iov is in keeping with the opinion of Aristotle. The opinion of Eliphaz is in keeping with the opinion of our law. The opinion of Bildad is in keeping with the doctrine of the Mutazila. The opinion of Zophar is in keeping with the doctrine of the Asheriyah. These were ancient opinions concerning providence. Thereupon, another opinion supervenes, namely, the one attributed to Elihu. Hence, he is considered by them as superior. Now, one of the very, very tricky things about Iov is that Elihu comes and, to a large degree, solves the problems, but it's not clear how his view is that different than the previous opinions. There are therefore different theories. The Ramban famously explains that Elihu was alluding to, though very obliquely, the idea of Gilgal. So let's see how the Rambam puts it. So here comes Elihu, and he is, as is clear from the book, giving a superior opinion. For it is mentioned that he was the youngest among them in point of age and most perfect among them in knowledge. He started to reprieve Iov and to tax him with his ignorance, because of his having manifested his self-esteem and because of his not being able to understand how misfortunes could have befallen him, though he performed good deeds. For he had expatiated at length on the goodness of his actions. Right? In other words, Iov is so troubled because he's a tzaddik, and yet he suffers so greatly. And it's not just he who says it's a tzaddik. The psukim themselves are very clear that Iov is a tzaddik. Now, one of the things that the Rambam had pointed out earlier is that It does say that Eov was Yari Elokim, but it doesn't say that he was a Chacham. And that is really what he lacks and what he's going to gain through this experience. The Rambam also does accept the opinion in Chazal that Eov was a Mashal. That should be kept in mind as well. He also described the opinions of Eov's three friends on Providence as senile drivel. Now, this is a little confusing, because remember, one of the three friends was the opinion of the Torah, wasn't it? Okay. And made extraordinary speeches that are full of enigmas in such a way that if someone considers his discourse, he wonders and thinks that he does not in any respect make an addition to what was said by Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, but merely repeats in different terms and with implications the notions contained in their speeches. So here the Rambam again, like we said before, notes that it's not clear what Elihu is adding. Clearly, he's unhappy with him. And indeed, God himself says, I'm unhappy with the positions of the three friends. The Rambam is going to quote Chazal as well shortly and say that even though Eov does say very inappropriate things, as the Gemara in Bava Basra says, Ein adam nitfas b'shas tzaro, and therefore God is not as upset as, he's not upset with Eov as he is with the three friends. But let's read on. For he does not go beyond blaming Eov, ascribing the attribute of justice to God, describing his wonders in the universe, and stating that he may be exalted, does not care either for the obedience of those who obey or for the disobedience of those who disobey. Now, all these notions had been expressed by his companions. However, when you consider the matter, the additional notion that he introduced will become clear to you. This notion is the one that is intended. It had not occurred before the others. So now the Rambam says, let's look carefully and see what does Elihu say that the previous thinkers did not. Together with that notion, however, he says all they have said, just as each of all the others, namely, Eov and his three friends, repeats, as I have mentioned to you, the notion expressed by another among them. This is done in order to hide the notion that is peculiar to the opinion of each individual, so that at first it occurs to the multitude that all the interlocutors are agreed upon the self-same opinions. The Rambam here alludes to the fact, and I guess along the similar lines, the Ramban, that there's something secret here, which is being hidden, so that if you don't know how to correctly read the story, you'll miss it. This is not so. The notion added by Elihu, and not mentioned by one of them, is that which he expresses parabolically when he speaks of the intercession of an angel. For he says that it is an attested and well-known thing that when a man is ill to the point of death, and when he is despaired of, if an angel intercedes for him, regardless of what angel, his intercession is accepted, and he is raised from his fall. This invalid is accordingly saved and restored to the best of status. So somebody's injured, and a malach comes and restores him. However, this does not continue always, there being no continuous intercession going on forever, for it only takes place two or three times. He says, if there be for him an angel, an intercessor, and so on, and having described the various states of the convalescent and his joy at returning to the perfection of health, he says, lo, all these things doth God work twice, yea, thrice with a man. This notion is made clear by Elihu alone. He also makes an addition prior to speaking of this notion by beginning to describe how of prophecy in the dictum for God speaketh once, ye twice, yet man perceiveth not. In a dream and a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon him. Thereupon he begins to confirm this opinion and make clear its methods by describing many natural circumstances, such as describing thunder, lightning, rain, many natural circumstances, and blowing of the wind. He combines this with many subjects belonging to the circumstances of animals. I mean, an outbreak of pestilence, refer to the dictum, in a moment they may die, at midnight, and so on. The occurrence of the great wars, refer to the dictum, he breaketh pieces, mighty men without number, and setteth others in their stead, and many other circumstances. Similarly, you will find that in the prophetic revelation that came to Job, through which his error in everything that he had imagined becomes clear to him, he is not going beyond the description of the natural matters, namely, description of the elements or description of the meteorological phenomenon or description of the nature of various species of animals, but nothing else. For what is mentioned therein in the way of a description of the firmaments in the heavens and Orion and the Pleiades occur because of their influence upon the atmosphere. For he draws his attention only to that which is beneath the sphere of the moon. Elihu, too, derives his warnings from the various species of animals. For he says, he teaches us from the beasts of the earth and maketh us wise from the fowls of the heaven. In this speech, he dwells at greatest length on the description of the Leviathan, whose accommodation of the corporeal properties divided between the animals that walk, swim, and fly. The purpose of all these things is to show that our intellects do not reach the point of apprehending how these natural things that exist in the world of generation and corruption are produced in time and of conceiving how the existence of the natural force within them has originated them. Okay, so one very important theme, we don't really understand that there is hashkacha, right? He describes the malach. Also, that we don't understand how the world works. These are not things that resemble what we make, right? The difference between the creations of God versus the creation of man. How then can we wish that the governance of and providence for them, may he be exalted, should resemble our governance and providence, the things that we govern and provide for? In other words, one aspect of Eov's error is he assumes that the way he governs or would administer providence should be the way God does. And in saying God is acting inappropriately, Eov is judging God. He's saying, in a sense, I would do things differently. So the critique is, what do you know? And it's absurd to think that you should know better because it's so different. How would we expect that it be the same? Rather, it is obligatory to stop at this point and believe that nothing is hidden from him, may be exalted. So at a certain point, you have to stop. Admit your ignorance and not judge. As Elihu says, for his eyes are upon the ways of man, and he sees all his doings. There's no darkness, no shadow of death, where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. But the notion of his providence is not the same as the notion of our providence, nor is the notion of his governance of the created things by him the same as the notion of our governance of that which we govern. The two notions are not comprised of what in one definition, contrary to what is thought by all those who are confused. And there is nothing in common between the two except the name alone. In the same way, our act does not resemble his God act, right? And the two are not comprised in one and the same definition. Just as natural acts differ from those of craftsmanship and do the divine governance of, the divine governance for, and the divine purpose with regard to, those natural matters differ from our human governance of providence for and purpose with regard to the things that we govern, we provide for, and we purpose. This is the object of the book of Eov as a whole. I refer to the establishing of this foundation for the belief and the drawing attention to the inference to be drawn from natural matters, so that you should not fall into error and seek to affirm in your imagination that his knowledge is like our knowledge, that his purpose and his providence and his governance are like our purpose, providence, and governance. If man knows this, every misfortune will be borne lightly by him. It's quite a statement. If you just realize this, then it won't be so hard. We'll talk about what this means in a moment. And the misfortunes will not add to his doubts regarding the deity and whether he does or does not know, or whether he exercises providence or manifests neglect, but will, on the contrary, add to his love. As I said in the conclusion of prophetic revelation and question, wherefore I abhor myself and repent of dust and ashes. So Eov does do tshuva. And the Rambam here again says something extraordinary. If you appreciate this, what happened in Eov? Eov experiences the suffering and it causes him to question, is God mashkiach or is he not? Is he just or is he not? The basis of that question is his assumption that he understands how things work. And when they don't work as he anticipated, so then he doubts. And the lesson is, or at least one lesson, I really think there are three lessons, but one lesson, maybe the major lesson, is that you shouldn't expect to understand. And when you don't expect to understand, then in a sense, it's easier to bear. And this really, in it, what bitachon is. But bitachon is appreciating that there's a purpose here, one which you might not understand. There's a goal, there's a direction. I don't know why this is happening. It doesn't seem fair to me, but I don't really know what's going on. Bitachon is trust. And what the Rambam here is saying, and this is really an idea that is said differently in many places, in many svarim, like the Chovos HaLevavos and Shaar Bitachon, is that if you have bitachon, then it's really much, you could experience tranquility even when experiencing these very challenging experiences because you have that trust. And the Rambam goes further. And again, this idea is also in Chazal, certainly, that they bring Ahava. And let's read on, we'll continue. As the sages, may their memory be blessed, have said, those who do out of love and are joyful in suffering. Gemar and Shabbos, these are the tzaddikim who act in love and are joyful in suffering. Right? So how could you be joyful in suffering? Suffering is not pleasant. Where's the joy? So the Rambam's saying that when you have this bitachon and when you have this humility, so then that becomes possible. If you mediate upon everything I've told you with the attention that ought to be practiced in mediating upon this treatise, and if you consider this book of Eov, its meaning will become clear to you, and you will find they have summed up all its notions, nothing being left aside except such matters as figures there because of the arrangement of the discourse and continuation of the parables, according to what I've explained to you several times in this treatise. Okay, the next chapter, he begins to talk about Nisayon. So, maybe it wasn't a good idea. I started in the middle of the chapter because I wanted to make sure we got to the end, but I probably could have actually started at the beginning. But let's try to understand this a little more. So, for one thing, the idea that the Rambam seems to be saying over here, the solution to the problem isn't that Hashem, it doesn't seem to be at least, is constantly being mashgiach. That's not the solution. The solution is you don't understand. But if you could appreciate that, then it won't bother you so much. In other words, it won't lead you to this. If you have the right values, if you have the appropriate understanding, then the suffering you experience won't trouble you. Now, I mentioned when we started off that Ibn Tibbon, Shmuel Ibn Tibbon, who was, as I said, a great scholar of the Rambam, his preferred translator, read this and understood in this paragraph, in this chapter, that the Rambam was basically saying, there is no hashgacha. And there is no hashgacha. But what's the solution? Don't worry, because if you have the right values and you have the right bitachon or the like, then if you are focused on the right things, then the suffering that you experience, the physical sickness or whatever it might be, won't cause you so much pain. And that's what, because the Rambam writes, as we noted, that look, Eov doesn't say he was, it says he was a fearer of God. Maybe he was a tzaddik, but he wasn't a chacham. And when he got that chachma, and when he sort of focused on it, the Rambam says that, look, Eov suffered so much from the loss of wealth and loss of health because he didn't appreciate what was most important, what's eternal. Health is temporary, wealth, temporary. If you really appreciate what's most important and you appreciate that you can't really expect to understand things and you can't expect to understand hashgacha and all those things, then it'll be okay. So that's why he thought, oh, basically the Rambam saying there's no hashgacha, and therefore he thought that there's a stira between what he says over here and what he sells elsewhere. Now, I don't think that, not sure why he really was bothered by this question, because in light of what he said elsewhere, we saw the Rambam certainly does believe in hashgacha, and he also believes that there isn't necessarily constant hashgacha. And therefore, unless you're going to be that person that is like the Avos, like Moshe Rabbeinu, who is constantly thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you won't always have constant hashgacha. In which case, when you're subject to teva, that could be very hard and feel unfair, feel unjust. And that's where the lesson of the Book of Eov comes in. Yes, there might be cases where you're subject to teva, and due to your being subject to teva, you suffer, and it will seem unfair. But A, appreciate your ignorance, that you can't really understand Hashgachas Hashem, and B, appreciate what's really most important, and not get carried away by focusing too much on the temporal. And if you could realize that, then the suffering won't get to you so much. So I want to make 3 points. Number one is, though the Rambam here makes it seem easy, it certainly isn't easy. And the Rambam himself, I think, would agree to that. I don't think the Rambam here is writing what it should be, what a person should strive for. I don't think the Rambam would say it's easy. We, in fact, have a letter that the Rambam writes where he's recalling the experience of losing his brother, David, whom he was very close with. And he writes that he was basically depressed. He doesn't use that word, but I think we would probably use that word. He said he had a hard time getting out of bed for a year. He was so depressed, he said. And still now, today, many years later, every time I see his writings in one of my sfarim, what sounds like his marginal notes or something like that, I am again saddened. And he writes about that year. He says, "Were not for Torah and Chachma that are my delight, I would have perished in sadness." So the Rambam, I don't think means to tell us over here that this is easy, but the Rambam is ambitious and he wants us to strive to understand. And the Rambam is telling us that If we do experience suffering, these are things we should remember. We should remember, A, that there is hashgacha. B, we can't expect to understand that hashgacha. And C, that to remember that which is eternal, that which lasts forever. And in a sense, those are the things that can't be taken away, at least not to the same degree. A person could lose their health, they could lose their wealth, they can't lose their mitzvos. They can't lose their dveikus, they can't lose their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And just knowing that makes it easier to deal with the suffering and this adversity. I want to just conclude, I guess. We had a little time to learn the Rambam, and we're going to another topic, but it's hard a little bit to leave, hard to move on. I want to conclude with a point that we made at the end of the previous year, which I think will be helpful in terms of being mechazek us going forward. The Rambam, on the one hand, sets the bar very high, as we've seen throughout, especially in terms of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But I think he also tells us something, and we noted this last time, but after I left, I was omit on it a little more, back in towards the end of 351. And he says something that I think that could help us a lot in terms of sort of learning from this. So we're going to go back to the very last paragraph of 351. Bring your soul to understanding this chapter and direct your efforts to multiplying of those times in which you are with God or endeavoring to approach him. So the Rambam says that in this chapter, he told us how to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he said, work on it, spend a lot of time, as much time as you can, connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being with Dabe, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or endeavoring. Now, why does he say it this way? So you could just say, do it, or, at least try to do it. Maybe if you try, you'll get it. But I don't think that's what he's saying. And I think what he is saying is that endeavoring to do it, trying to do it, is in and of itself a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, we should try, and hopefully we'll sometimes succeed. But even if we don't succeed, we should appreciate that we've done something. I think that's what the Rambam is saying over here. If a person tries to daven with kavana and they succeed, so that's great. If you try to daven with kavana and you don't succeed, you've still done something. It's very different than davening without kavana, not having tried. There is a accomplishment in, like he says, endeavoring to approach him. And like he says as well, decrease the times in which you are not connecting to him or not attempting to approach him. That too is an accomplishment. Trying is an accomplishment. And as I said, in a practical sense, we all, at least certainly I struggle davening with kavana, but eino dome, the tefillah where you actually did try, and okay, still didn't work, versus you just went through the motions, like he said, like you're talking to a wall, and not talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not talking to Elokim Chaim. And if you try, so then you will have succeeded. And that's sort of the lesson that the Rambam leaves us with in his discussion on Hashgacha. It's one that I think is empowering, and it's mechazek us, especially when it's hard. And we all went through a Yantif of Pesach, which is all about seeing and appreciating the Hashgacha in terms of especially the Ashkacha and Kal Yisrael, and as well as from that to learn to the Hashkacha in our own lives. Okay, so I'll stop here. So for next time, so I think Ari was suggesting that maybe Tanya isn't a good choice.